one of those weeks when the Colorado weather goes from summer to winter in less than 24 hours. Welcome to Go West Young Podcast, your show about America's parks and public lands. I'm Aaron Weiss at the Center for Western Priorities in Denver. On the show today, we are heading way up north to Alaska, where a pair of court victories for conservation groups could provide a playbook for challenging the Trump administration over the next couple years. We will talk to an attorney from Earth Justice about what it all means. Plus, they call it the town too tough to die, but how did Tombstone, Arizona get its name? We'll find out this week in Western history, but first, let's do the news. Once again, the big stories are all about David Bernhardt, the acting Secretary of the Interior, who could be confirmed as permanent secretary by the Senate as early as Wednesday. We have talked on this podcast about David Bernhardt's secretive calendar practices before, but now we are finally learning why he didn't want the public to know what he was up to as deputy secretary. Right before Bernhardt's confirmation hearing in the Senate, Interior finally released Bernhardt's actual daily schedule. What they released is vastly different from the public calendars they had released for Bernhardt before. We counted more than 200 significant discrepancies between these so-called daily cards that they just released and what had been public before. Roll call counted at least 260 differences. So, what was kept off of David Bernhardt's public calendars? Well, there's a listing for a meeting with Jean Sagusp, who is the chairman of a group called CSER that opposes the Endangered Species Act. David Bernhardt was on the board of CSER and represented the group in court. Despite that meeting showing up on two different versions of Bernhardt's calendar for that day and Sagusp signing into the Interior Department that morning, Interior now says, oh, no, sorry, he actually met with someone else, not David Bernhardt. The list goes on and on. Meetings with Cimarex, which is an energy company that's part of the Independent Petroleum Association of America. A meeting with Shell Oil, which is a member of the National Ocean Industries Association. Bernhardt represented both of those trade groups, but now Interior says his ethics recusals don't apply in those cases, and they didn't explain why those meetings weren't on his public calendars in a transparent way before that. CNN pointed to a coffee between Bernhardt and Ed Manning. Manning is a lobbyist out of California who has spent years representing Westland's Water District, yet another of Bernhardt's clients. Interior claims that meeting didn't happen either, but did not say how it got on Bernhardt's calendar in the first place. Now, the kicker is that these daily cards were being kept in a Google document that was overwritten at the end of each day, and we only know about them because of a source at Interior who told us about them. And then Raul Grijalva, the chairman of the House Natural Resources Committee, had to ask Interior for them specifically. And even these calendars that we do finally have are incomplete. Entire days are missing. So either Interior wasn't saving Bernhardt's calendar like they're required to, or they're trying to hide something even worse than what they've already disclosed. Either way, it's not a good look. And the hits keep on coming. So remember when David Bernhardt ordered the Bureau of Land Management to go back to work during the government shutdown so they could approve more oil drilling? Well, we now know that they approved 267 drilling permits during the shutdown, including four in the Pawnee National Grasslands near Denver. Those permits in the grasslands went to Noble Energy, and Noble Energy is, you guessed it, a former client of David Bernhardt's. There's a whole CNN story about that. And David Bernhardt's former lobbying and law firm is cashing in this whole time. The Washington Post reports that the Natural Resources Division at Brownstein Hyatt Farber Schreck has quadrupled its business since Bernhardt rejoined Interior, pulling in nearly $5 million last year alone to lobby the Department of the Interior, which is now run by its former head, David Bernhardt. So, it is not surprising that all of these revelations taken together are turning David Bernhardt into the next Ryan Zinke, who, of course, you'll recall, left Interior under a cloud of investigations. There is already a preliminary investigation from Interior's Inspector General into whether Bernhardt violated his ethics obligations when he issued an order to harm the Delta smelt, that small fish, at the behest of Westland's Water District. Senator Ron Wyden has requested a criminal investigation into whether Bernhardt and Brownstein Hyatt violated lobbying disclosure laws, and two House committees are requesting transcribed on-the-record interviews with those Interior staffers who kept those vanishing calendars. So all of this is to say that even if Bernhard is confirmed this week, his troubles are only getting started. Conservation groups won a pair of huge court victories in Alaska at the end of March, and they could have implications across the country. One of those rulings put the brakes on a road that would have gone through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge. The other stopped President Trump's plan to open up oil and gas drilling off Alaska and in canyons in the Atlantic Ocean. Joining us on the line from Anchorage, Eric Graffy, an attorney with Earth Justice. Eric, thank you so much for taking the time.
Hi, great to be here.
So let's take those rulings one at a time, starting with the offshore case, since Earth Justice was an attorney on the case. Walk us through what happened and what the judge found.
Sure. I'll start with the context, which is that as one of his signature acts of conservation, President Obama permanently withdrew the vast majority of the Arctic Ocean and important canyons in the Atlantic from offshore drilling before he left office. And when President Trump came into office in April 2017, he issued an executive order that purported to undo these protections. And we sued the president, claiming that he lacked the authority to undo the protections that President Obama had put in place. And on Friday, Judge Sharon Gleason in the Federal District Court in Alaska agreed with us and ruled that President Trump had acted unconstitutionally when he issued his executive order purporting to undo the bans. And she vacated President Trump's executive order and reinstated the protections that President Obama had put in place. And so as a result, the Arctic Ocean, the vast majority of the Arctic Ocean, is now off limits to offshore drilling, and important areas in the Atlantic is similarly protected.
And this wasn't a ruling saying that they didn't jump through the right hoops and needed to go back. This is saying President Trump and whoever the Interior Secretary is at the time, they don't have this authority at all to do this without Congress. Is that right?
That's absolutely right. And the reason is because President Obama acted pursuant to a statute, the Outer Continental Shelf Lands Act, and there's a provision in that statute that grants the president the power to withdraw areas from leasing. And it is silent as to the power to undo those protections. What the court found is that because the Constitution vests in Congress the power over public lands management and disposition, Congress can delegate that power to the president, and it's done so. But the only source of power for the president to act is what Congress delegates. And the court reaffirmed the principle that a delegation of the power to protect doesn't carry with it the power to undo protections. So she found that President Trump had acted outside of his authority and in violation of separation of powers principles and the Constitution.
So everything you just said is taking me back to an episode of this podcast we did a year and a half ago, maybe 2 years ago, with Mark Squillaci, a law professor at the University of Colorado, when we were talking about national monuments and President Trump's attempts to roll back, shrink Bears Ears and Grand Staircase. And he was making essentially the exact same point, but in regards to the Antiquities Act, that it is written as a one-way statute. So do you think that this Alaska offshore case could end up having an impact on the monuments case in Utah?
I certainly think it's a boost for that litigation because this case depends, or both cases depend, on the same basic principle, which is that Congress sets the rules for public lands and waters, and a power to establish protection doesn't automatically include the power to undo that protection.
And just take us back to Constitution 101, this is the property clause of the Constitution?
That's right. Mm-hmm. Article 4 and the property clause that vests in Congress the sole authority over the management and disposition of public lands and waters.
So walk us through what are the impacts then as this case, I presume, will be appealed. Obviously, we've seen Senator Murkowski was not at all happy with this, and she was hoping for the fast-trained offshore drilling. What is a case like this that hinges on essentially a constitutional interpretation? What does that look like throughout the appeals process, as opposed to something that hinges on did you follow NEPA or did you follow the law, but truly the law doesn't let you do this at all kind of question?
Well, certainly the government may appeal, but we're confident in our argument, and we think the court got it right. The judge issued a detailed and well-reasoned opinion, and so we're ready to defend that opinion. And as of today, the law of the land is that these sensitive waters in the Arctic Ocean and in the Atlantic are off limits to leasing. And that's immediately consequential because the Trump administration is barreling ahead with opening all of our coasts to oil and gas drilling. And this ruling puts in place protections for these really important areas and will prevent the administration from offering oil and gas leases in those areas.
The specific ruling here also affected a lifting on a moratorium in drilling in certain canyons in the Atlantic. Could it have an impact on what Interior does as they look at all offshore drilling in the whole country? I mean, could this end up having an impact there? We've already seen with David Bernhardt's nomination some hand-wringing from the Republican senators in Florida who do not want to see Florida offshore drilling opened up. Is this narrowly written, or could this end up impacting what Interior tries to do offshore elsewhere?
Well, I think it could impact the five-year planning process, which is the process to which you're referring, which sets a schedule for leasing and which currently is considering leases in all sorts of areas. This ruling only protects the areas that were withdrawn, the Arctic areas and the Atlantic canyons. However, the administration has been moving forward with this schedule on the basis that we need more oil, and the areas that have a lot of oil, the Arctic has potentially a lot of oil, was one of the main justifications for the overall plan. And so those justifications are starting to fall by the wayside. And so I think it will complicate the nationwide schedule, and it really should put the administration going back to the drawing board as to its assessment of where to open for leasing.
And I suppose that brings us to this other ruling, issued same day, same judge, but regarding the road through the Eisenbeck National Wildlife Refuge to King Cove. This was going to be an 11-mile gravel road. Lisa Murkowski, again, has been one of the strongest champions of this road. But in this case, unlike some fundamental constitutional question, the judge just said that Ryan Zinke didn't do his job, didn't explain why he made this decision. Now, I know you didn't work on this case, so I don't want to ask you to get into the details, but is the big picture here similar to what you're talking about with offshore? Is the Interior Department not doing its homework, crossing I's, dotting T's, in making decisions that are subject to challenge down the road?
Yes, I'd say that President Trump and his Interior Department's lawlessness is catching up with them. So in the case of the Eisenbeck Road, it was a reversal of policy without adherence to basic administrative law procedures. And with respect to the ocean, it was President Trump himself overstepping his authority under a statute and under the Constitution. And elsewhere in the country, we're seeing the courts stand up repeatedly to the Trump administration's all-out push to open up public lands without following basic administrative law procedures and basic environmental procedures that are designed to inform the public about the risks of opening up these areas and inform decision makers about those risks. And the Trump administration, we're seeing just completed, shortcut all of those procedural requirements and try to usurp power that they don't have in the case of the ocean.
Give us a sense of the timelines here. If either or both of these rulings are appealed, Alaska is in the Ninth Circuit. Is that correct?
That's right. We're in the Ninth Circuit.
Give us a sense of what the timing is on an appeals process on something like this. Is it possible that this is all still going through the courts at the end of President Trump's first term?
Well, I don't want to speculate. It would be speculative to try to predict, other than to say that we feel confident in our position and with respect to the ocean case, and will defend the judge's order should it be appealed.
What other cases either are you working on or watching that Earth Justice or other organizations are working on that you think will be the next bellwethers that we should keep our eye out for as they make their way through the courts?
Well, let me address that by talking about the Arctic writ large. This case addressed the Arctic Ocean, but the Arctic is all interconnected, and what happens in the ocean affects what happens on land. And the Arctic onshore is also a target of the President Trump administration's zeal to open areas for oil. So, for example, the administration is moving ahead with oil and gas lease sales in the Western Arctic and oil and gas drilling in that area, moving ever closer to really sensitive areas like Teshekpuk Lake. And we're in court trying to hold the line against that expansion. And the administration is also moving forward with developing a leasing program for the Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. And we and our allies and colleagues are heavily engaged in that administrative process. And so overall, there is a big threat still in the Arctic and elsewhere from the Trump administration. And they're moving forward in ways that are shortcutting and violating the law and trying to cut out public input and aren't assessing the risks to the region or, importantly, the risks to the climate of continuing to try to expand fossil fuel development in an area that would, even if it could be produced safely, oil and gas won't come to market for decades and decades. And we need to be transitioning now from fossil fuel, not trying to lock in fossil fuel for decades to come. And that's a reality that the administration isn't assessing in its documents or its policy.
Climate was my next question. We saw a ruling out of Wyoming blocking lease sales, saying that BLM did not properly consider the climate impacts of offering several hundred thousand more acres for lease. Is that line of argument something you think we're going to see in more cases now that it has worked in at least one federal courthouse?
Yeah, I think it's worked in a number of cases, and I think absolutely that the law is now pretty clearly that when the government assesses a fossil fuel project on public lands, one of the impacts that it needs to assess is how the oil or the coal that's taken out of the ground will affect the climate. So you can't be forever expanding fossil fuel development while closing your eyes to how that affects our commitments to and our urgent need to address climate change. So I think that's a welcome development. And I think we will see more of that. Hopefully the government will start doing those assessments and in light of those assessments, making better choices and or at least getting pressure from the public to make choices that don't relegate us to ever further climate disaster.
All right, last question is a curveball. This is one that I usually ask politicians, but I think Lisa Murkowski is not going to take up my invitation to come on this podcast anytime soon. So I'm going to ask you instead, since you're the first person we've had on this podcast from Alaska, what is your perfect 48, 72 hours off the grid in Alaska? Obviously, there's a lot of ground to cover. Where do you go? What's the perfect thing that folks should experience when they come to Alaska?
Oh, well, my perfect thing is I spend a lot of time at my a cabin that my in-laws have up near Denali Park, and they have sled dogs, and I spend time up there with the sled dogs and with my 2.5-year-old daughter, teaching her how to ride on the sled and just enjoy the beautiful nature that we have up there. So you really can't go wrong anywhere in this state. That just happens to be my happy place.
A toddler with sled dogs. I mean, that's as good as it gets right there. All right. Eric Graffy is an attorney with Earth Justice in Anchorage. Eric, thank you so much for taking the time and for all of your knowledge and expertise today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. I really appreciate it too. Thank you.
We always wrap up with a look back at this week in Western history. It was early April 1877 when a prospector named Ed Schifflin started digging for silver in the hills of what's now Cochise County, Arizona. It was a dangerous gamble. They were about 12 miles from the Chiricahua Apache tribe led by Cochise and Geronimo. 20 years before that, another prospector had found a small deposit of silver in the area, but he was found dead in his mine, run through with a rock drill. The German cook blamed Mexican miners for that murder. That prospector's cabin was the site of some 22 murders in the frontier era, but Schifflin decided to use it as his base to launch a new survey. When a friend of his found out about it, he told Schifflin, "The only rock you'll find out there will be your own tombstone." But Schifflin found silver ore in a dry wash, and he knew he was onto something. A few months later, he tracked down the source, a vein he thought was 50 feet long and a foot wide. When Ed filed his first mining claim, he named his stake Tombstone. Now, there was just one problem. Ed only had 30 cents in his pocket. So he set out to find his brother Al, who he hadn't seen in 4 years. Al was working at a silver mine way up in northern Arizona. Ed didn't find him until February 1978. And the foreman at that mine thought that Ed's ore specimens were mostly lead. Ed was so frustrated he tossed his ore out his brother's cabin door, then held on to three of them at the last minute. A couple weeks later, a new assayer showed up at the mine, and it turns out he valued that worthless ore at $2,000 a ton. Ed, Al, and the assayer formed a partnership on the spot, shaking hands on a gentleman's agreement that was never put down on paper. The deal would make all three of them millionaires. They loaded up a wagon, bought a mule, and headed back south to that cabin, where they found several fresh graves, locals killed by the Apaches. But the three partners kept at it. They found another claim nearby that assayed at $15,000 a ton. In March 1879, a surveyor laid out a new town site, which they named Tombstone, after Schifflin's first mining claim. And the very next week, Al and Ed Schifflin sold their interest in the Tombstone Mining and Milling Company for $1 million. Tombstone turned into a boomtown. It became the county seat 2 years later. Al built a theater and called it Schifflin Hall. That's still standing today. 1881 saw the infamous showdown at the OK Corral when Wyatt Earp and Doc Holliday faced off with the Clantons, the notorious cattle rustlers who were protected by a corrupt sheriff. By the mid-1880s, there were officially 7,000 miners living in Tombstone, with another 5,000 to 7,000 women, children, Chinese, Mexican, prostitutes, all of whom who weren't on the official rolls. More than 100 places were licensed to sell liquor. Most of them sold other things as well. By 1884, the miners had taken $25 million out of the ground, and the hotels, saloons, gambling dens, and brothels were running 24/7. Then, at the end of the decade, the mines hit the water table, and that was the end of the silver boom. Tombstone's population died out until it became the tourist attraction it still is today. So, in a way, Ed Schifflin's friend was right. He did find his tombstone in the Arizona hills 142 years ago this week in Western history. That is it for this episode of Go West Young Podcast. Thanks again to Eric Graffy from Earth Justice for his insight on the legal situation in Alaska. Of course, we'll keep tabs on David Bernhardt's confirmation vote and the investigations. And hey, if you liked this episode, I would really appreciate it if you left us a review on Apple Podcasts. That is how new listeners can find us. And if you want to send us email, love letters, hate mail, we love ideas for future episodes, you can do that podcast@westernpriorities.org. We will be back next week with another episode. In the meantime, I'm Aaron Weiss, and on behalf of all of us at the Center for Western Priorities, thanks for listening.
I want you to know it's over.
Well, bye.